You are listening to Powder Radio. Brought to you by Powder Magazine. Welcome to Sponsored, brought to you by Powder Magazine. I'm your host, Mike Powell, and this week is our second to last week of the Sponsored podcast, and time has flown by. When we started with Sean Pettit back in September, I really had no idea what we were doing, but I knew we were going to create some gold with these Sponsored podcasts. Fast forward 32 weeks and we've got some great content. There is no plan for a season two right now with Sponsored. There could be one, but I am not in the driver's seat to direct that. So we'll see if that happens. If not, you'll always have amazing content from me coming out weekly on thepowellmovement.com. That's my other podcast that focuses on all action sports. This week on Sponsored, we have Marc-Andre Béliveau, and let me tell you, Marc's story is a roller coaster of emotions. It starts with Marc learning how to ski and getting really good at skiing, and Marc works his way to the top of the ski industry only to see his sister break her back. Then Marc breaks his back. Then his brother breaks his back. We'll talk about the injuries in Marc's career, as well as the ups and downs that happened, and who made it easy for Marc to become a professional skier. So get ready for some interesting conversation with Marc-Andre Béliveau.
Hey.
How's it going, man?
Not too bad, yourself?
Oh, pretty good, thank you.
Yeah?
Yeah. How you been?
I've been okay.
Okay, what's been going on?
I'm starting new work. I did a class to become a draftman.
A draftman, which is
like art? Drawing, 3D, to make blueprints.
Like an architect.
Yeah, but we do structure where I'm working.
Okay.
Yeah.
When did you go back to school?
Not this summer, but the summer before. I went for 1 year. It was a pretty quick class.
And how was that, man? Because you probably hadn't been in school in, what, like 20 years or 15 years?
Yeah, exactly. It was kind of hard, but I really liked the school. The people that were taking the class with me were very awesome. So we had a good time.
Were you the old guy?
No. It was more of an adult crowd, I guess. More immigrants and people that wanted to go back to school also.
Got to people that actually care about school, not like their parents forcing them to go?
Yeah. Yeah.
Recently, you've been at the JPM Memorial, and I guess I should talk to you first and foremost about how the JP event was, and it was a first-year event in Whistler, and I know he's an important person in your life, and how'd that event go?
It was very fun. There was a good crowd there, a lot of people that I didn't see for a long time, and I guess we had a very good time, yeah.
Since 2010, have you been connected with many people in the ski industry?
I kind of lost touch a little bit with pretty much everybody, but I kept skiing and I kept working at the resort here.
Okay.
That's how I kept in touch with the skiing world, but in a different way, you know?
Yeah.
I find it hard to keep touch with people I don't see very often.
Yeah, I'm in the same way. I mean, you have social media, so you know what everybody's doing. But yeah, in terms of like actually communicating with people, it doesn't really happen much on my end. So glad you're on the podcast. You've had a shit ton of things happen to you, and you've been in a ton of different situations. And I'm not just talking about your injury, because your story's crazy, I think, from way before and any injuries. And it'll be cool to see how it started and talk about skiing throughout your life and then music throughout your life, because I think that's just as important as skiing, if not more important. And I want to find out first, I guess, where were you born and raised?
I was born close to Montreal, but I spent most of my life growing up in Quebec City.
Okay. And so you were a city kid growing up?
In the suburb.
Okay. I believe you have a sister. And was it mom, dad, and sister growing up?
I have an older brother, too, that was skiing a lot. Yeah, so we all started skiing together with my family.
When did you start skiing?
When I was 9 years old, I think.
Okay. And did you play any other sports other than skiing when you were growing up?
I was playing hockey, actually.
Good hockey player?
Yeah, not too bad, but I played till I was like 10 years old, maybe 10, 11. So I was in the big teams, like the big regional and provincial team, but my family started skiing without me, basically. And I was kind of sick of hockey because it was taking too much time.
Yeah, I guess if you're one of those serious hockey kids, you're traveling and you're almost not living at home.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, so I thought it was too much, and I was kind of jealous of my family. My brother and my sister were skiing a lot, so I wanted to go ski with them instead of playing hockey. So I dropped hockey at the time.
And were the coaches pissed when you dropped hockey?
No, but it was very hard because I felt like I was doing something wrong by ditching the team.
Right.
I felt like it was personal, maybe kind of a failure because I always played hockey before, and my parents were supporting me a lot in that. Yeah, it was a very hard choice. I don't know why I quit it and I never went back. That's pretty much how I did, and I did regret for a long time. I felt cheap. I don't know how to explain it, but I felt like it was a wrong thing to quit hockey.
It sounds like you quit hockey and you're kind of bummed out on yourself for doing it. And like you say, there's regret, but just hearing it in your voice, it sounds like you're genuinely bummed that you quit it at some point. Do you feel like you were letting your friends down or just yourself down? Because I'm sure if you're on those provincial teams, you're pretty good and there can be a future. And it's like you have to choose between family or hockey, and you chose family, which is the best choice at the end of the day. But where's the guilt? It sounds like you're bummed on it.
Yeah, I don't know. I always had a hard time to make choices, I think.
Okay.
I made that choice in on emotion, I think. Either on frustration or I don't know what kind of mood I was, but I know I was kind of in a weird mood.
You've probably been in and out of different weird moods throughout your whole life. And this is maybe one of them that happened, and you end up leaving the hockey team. But you get into skiing, and more, I think your dad eventually becomes one of your coaches in skiing, and you're skiing with your brother and sister. Is that right?
Actually, my parents, they always supported us in competitive skiing, but we always had other coaches, you know. The second year we were skiing, we started skiing moguls in the regional and provincial team around here.
Were there some pretty big names on that team with yourself? Because I would think at that point in time, there was a lot of guys making the moves to focus on moguls. And who were you skiing with then?
GP was in the team, and a lot of other really good guy from Quebec, but and once we grew up and we became better, we started being on the provincial team, and that's when we met all the Montreal area people like Vincent, GF Cusson, and Pierre-Alexandre Rousseau, and they all made the national team before they got into the free skiing.
Yeah, so this is just before the whole ski world's about to change. At this point, you're skiing bumps, but in the grand scheme of things, in the snow world, snowboarding is dominating. While you're part of the coolest segment of skiing, which is bump skiing, there's not much in skiing that you can really sell to like a 13-year-old as cool. And how do you guys find this new school of skiing?
Well, when we were skiing moguls, we thought when we were young that it was the coolest thing ever, you know. At first, there wasn't any half pipe or any jumps, like tabletops at the resort. The jumps we had were the ones we made ourselves and the one in the moguls and stuff. As soon as there was half pipe at the mountains or tabletops, we started skiing and jumping on it. It took a few years still to pick up, I think.
Okay. And at that point, Stoneham is your mountain that you're skiing at home.
Yeah.
When you're growing up as well, a big influence in your life is also music. And when did music start coming into your life? Because right now, I'm guessing while you're on this mogul team, you're probably 13, 14, and skiing is a passion, but is music there as well?
Yeah, man, I started playing music and writing song when I was like 11 or 12 years old.
Okay.
That's when I started. So it was always parallel. I would always play music with my friends at night. So it was pretty much something that I did. It was always in my life since I was like 11 or 10, you know.
Are your parents musicians as well?
No, nobody plays music in my family, my close family anyways. It's my cousin that got me into it.
Okay, because you definitely have a talent there, and it's funny that no one else that's your immediate blood does anything remotely close to play music.
Yeah, I guess my mother was singing when I was young, and she got me into singing. Just like child song and folk song, you know, from Quebec.
Yeah. And then at this point in your life, too, you're a teenager. And while I think you were working a little bit of construction, you're also working in the kitchen. But I believe there was a period in your time where you're also robbing cars and kind of a criminal. Is there any truth to that in your life at about maybe 14 to 18 years old?
Yeah, I did some stupid stuff when I was younger. Yeah.
Okay, that's it. Okay, I mean, I think the statute of limitations have run out.
I'm not very proud of that period. Just getting drunk and doing stupid stuff.
Was there any trouble that you got in that followed you around after that? Were there any arrests or anything from those young years?
When I was young, I went to a kind of jail for youngster because, I went to jail, I guess. But that was before I was 18 years old, so now it's all behind me, I guess.
Yeah, but when you go to jail as a youngster like that, they probably put you into an area with a bunch of kids that have some experience with the criminal element, and you come out of a place like that even worse off than when you went in.
Yeah, I'm not sure. Like I said, I always had a hard time to make choices. When I was taking wrong choices, I was probably the one the most punished.
Okay.
Even though I might have wanted to hurt somebody, but the one really getting hurt was me because I felt really shitty about doing shitty stuff, I guess. I was not very proud of it. When I got arrested, people will influence me in the wrong way really easily, I guess.
I'm guessing you always said yes, and if it was choosing between being smart or having fun, you usually chose to have fun?
Yeah, or dumb.
Yeah. There's, hey, I could be home by midnight and I don't have to worry about getting in trouble, or hey, we can do this, we'll be out to 3 a.m. and it could get crazy. You're always going to be, at least at that point in your life, you were always going to be the guy like, I'm going with plan B and we're going to be out till 3 a.m.
Yeah.
Yeah. There's nothing wrong with that. It's just when you get caught, there is.
Mm-hmm, true that.
But at some point, you have ski sponsors who come after you, and around 2000, you're skiing, and you get third in the U.S. Free Ski Open, and there's a couple other international big air events that you got on the podium. And while you're dirtbagging it at that point of your life, getting to these events, and I heard a rumor that you might have slept in a church the night you won the Free Ski Open, but not sure if that's true or not.
Yes.
Is it true?
Yeah. I was with Phil Bélanger, one of the three Phils, and we didn't even travel together, but we ended up at the same time at the airport in Denver.
Okay.
Then we ended up like catching a bus to go to Denver, but we arrived super late. I can't remember, but when we were at the bus stop, we had no idea where we were going to go from there. So the bus stop was closing because it was like 11 o'clock or so at night.
Okay.
It's the police that came and picked us up and brought us to the church in Vail so we could sleep there on the floor.
Wait, the police brought you from Denver to Vail?
No. We took the bus to Vail from the Denver airport. And then once we were there, we had no idea where we were going to sleep. So, yeah, it's pretty funny. It was with Phil LaRose. It was not with Phil Bélanger. It was with Phil LaRose and his brother.
Okay. I think that's dirtbagging it at its finest form right there, sleeping in a church. But you get third in that contest. And at that point in time, the U.S. Free Ski Open is like the biggest thing in skiing. And people are coming there from all over the world because if they get on the podium at that event, they're going to get sponsors. And you did get on the podium and you did get a sponsor. And I believe it was Vocal that picked you up and gave you a bunch of travel money.
Yeah, true that. Yeah, it took maybe a few months or a year before I got really on the team. But that podium and the fact that GP O'Claire really helped me out at first to try to connect. Actually, that's him who introduced me to the guy from Vocal in Europe. So he made the bridges, and then I started traveling. Yeah, with a little bit of budget.
And I would think, and I'm just going to go and preface this, and you can tell me to shut up and that I'm wrong, but I'm going to guess that I could be right, is that the business part of the ski career was not your forte. Negotiating contracts, finding sponsors, and being on time and answering emails might not have been as important as the actual skiing to you. Would that be a fair assessment?
Oh, yeah, true that. I've never really been a businessman, and I never really promoted myself as others would actually and be really successful, you know. Even on the skiing side, maybe if I would have been more focused, I would have probably made a better job, you know.
I think you have to look at it in a couple ways. First, and I mean this is no disrespect whatsoever, but being a Canadian in a North American market that's dominated by the U.S. skiers and the bulk of the sales in the U.S., you have to work even harder, I feel like, being a Canadian. There's only one Sean Pettit, but there's not a ton of Canadian pros I can name off the top of my head. I mean, Ian McIntosh, and sure, there's plenty. But it seems like it's easier if you're an American, especially at that point in the ski industry where the bulk was down here in the States. And then at the same time, you're not the squeaky wheel. You're not the guy who's going to be like, hey, put me on this poster. Hey, send me here. Do this, do that. You're kind of like, hey, these guys gave me a check. This is fucking awesome. I'm going to go to New Zealand, right?
Yeah, but I think it's funny because I think the fact that I was Canadian really helped me out. Yeah, I think I was kind of an outsider a little bit. I don't know. I think it's more of the seriousness or like more focus would have been better for me. You know, I was a little bit spread out. Yeah, when I was on skis, I would think about skis, but then when I was off the mountains, I would think of something else, you know, but not the business side.
And you had a lot of things going. I mean, you were playing music. I can't say it enough. When you play music, I mean, it's at a very high level. So it's like you're skiing at a top pro level. And at the time, the skiing that you're doing is game changing. Just the switch landings and making that look effortless. There's not many people doing that at that time. But then you can also go hit park jumps and win slope style contests and big airs. So you're doing something that there's not too many skiers that are able to do both. But given at the same time, the professional side for you is more of like a chill, laid back, like I'm going to have a good time and let my skiing speak for itself, which is fine in some respects. You're only going to get so far in your career doing that, but you can get pretty far when you're as good as you are. And it seems like you eventually go to New Zealand and that's where you meet Rosendahl and that's where things really start taking off.
Yeah, exactly. I think that trip definitely put me on the map, like internationally, because it was a big international competition.
Was like a World Heli Challenge or something like that?
Yeah, exactly. So it was all big mountain, and I've never done any before. So that really opened my eye on that kind of skiing. And then Rosendahl, like, really supported me and really helped me out at first and through my career to stay on top, you know?
I feel like he might have stepped in and been like the responsible party at certain points in your career.
Oh, yeah, for sure. I feel like I was lazy and I would be surrounded with people that were really on top of their stuff.
Yep.
That's why I got up in the morning and went to the mountains, you know, every day, because I was living with Steve and Peter O'Brien and Alex O'Brien, who were really hard workers, much more focused than I was. I was basically brought everywhere. They would just bring me over to places, you know, and I would just had to follow them, and then it would be sure that I was gonna be like skiing and probably getting some stuff done, you know, but by myself. I don't think, like, I was doing the right move, you know. Every year I would leave Quebec and then I would go to Steve House, you know, and yeah, that was my biggest move, and that's why I had a career, actually.
Okay, so you looked to them to motivate you. It was like you were the talent and you needed the motivation. So you guys both brought things to the table that made it work.
Yeah, true that.
So you're with Steve and you're filming a bunch for Volume. I think you had a profile with them. You're in the interview issue. And throughout the whole filming of Volume, I think Steve made sure that he was including you in things there because he wanted to. And he really believed in you and your career. But you're also starting to shoot with TGR. I think you shot with them for about 6-7 years. And how did that relationship start? How did you meet the guys from TGR?
I actually got in because I was hanging out with Peter O'Brien that was living at Steve's.
Okay.
That was my door. And also I was hanging out with Sage and Chris Collins and all those guys.
Yep.
from Utah. So they started filming with them before me. And Peter O'Brien started filming for them too. And I was living at the same house as Peter, so every time Pete was going out, he would bring me with him. Every time he brought his camera out, I was there with the other guys. So it really made it easy for me to get some stuff done, because I was basically never going skiing just for skiing, because those guys were working so hard. I was always hitting some big stuff and some stuff that they prep, you know?
Yep.
So I basically feel like I was just tagging along, you know? the whole career.
You can say tagging along, but at the same time, if those guys weren't getting you up every day, making sure you were getting in the truck and going out and skiing, they wouldn't have as much amazing footage they had. So it's a trade-off for sure. And in talking to those guys, they were saying that at that time, you would come in from skiing, you would take off your ski boots and your ski pants at the same time, and you'd strip them down so your pants were sitting inside of your ski boots. You'd walk around all evening just in your long johns, and then the next morning you'd wake up and just step right back into your ski boots and you're ready to go.
Yeah, that's pretty much how it was, yeah.
So you were kind of like the dirtbag on the couch, but that dirtbag on the couch had more talent than anybody in the house.
Yeah, and without probably, I wouldn't say more than the other people, but...
Athletic talent.
I had probably an ease, you know, but the people I was skiing with, they were super talented, you know, so that really...
Oh, no, I meant the people you were living with, not the people you were skiing with. You had the athletic ability at the house of Alex O'Brien, Peter O'Brien, and Steve Rosendahl.
Yeah, but they were really good snowboarders, huh? They were even sponsored and stuff. So before they started filming, they were professional athletes themselves. So they kind of showed me the way. They were working really hard before they were filming, and they kind of... showed me how to do it, you know.
It sounds like they didn't want you to fuck it up, and they had a little bit of knowledge, and they were like, hey man, if we don't look out for this guy, he is gonna fuck it up, but if we do, we can put him on a path to a career. And that's what happened.
Yeah, true that.
So it's cool. I mean, because they're all, I mean, it's, they weren't thinking of building your career at that point. They were thinking, hey, we're just gonna hang with our buddy and whatever. And it's cool that that's how it evolved. Now, in terms of a not so happy time in this point of your life, your sister, I think she's very competitive skiing and takes a day off from her racing or whatever she's doing, her mogul skiing. And she ends up having an accident where she breaks her back. And I don't know if she's paralyzed or not, but I know it's a huge impact on you, your father, your whole family. And what happens with your sister?
Yeah, my sister, she was training for the Olympics, and then she got cut off right before the Olympics in Salt Lake City. So she was pretty bummed out, and she decided she was going to come and hang out with us. And then we went on a trip for the end of the season, at almost 2 months probably that we were together. And then we were in California skiing with Matt Sturbins and a couple other guys. And then she broke her back, yeah, right in front of us. And she almost got paralyzed, and she spent maybe a month and a half at the hospitals there before she could leave, because she was she had surgery and stuff. Yeah, that really bummed me out. I felt really responsible for my sister that she got hurt. Like, I remember the phone call that I made to my dad to tell her that Rachel was all fucked up. And his reaction was like feeling that I was pretty much responsible for her accident, you know, because we were doing crazy shit.
Yeah, and so that's got to crush you.
Yeah, yeah, I got really, really bummed out. And I started feeling really, really shaky about, like, keeping skiing. And I actually thought that I was not going to go ski anymore, like, that I was going to stop filming and doing crazy stuff, you know. But she was the first one telling me, like, ah, man, it was a bad luck, Mark. You don't want to quit skiing just because I got hurt, blah, blah. And she was the one, the first one motivating me, you know?
Yeah. And you're pretty much an emotional roller coaster, I would think, of a person. And our interaction over the years hasn't been too much by any means, but in just talking to you, hearing about you, and reading about you, it's like when these things happen, they can really put you in the gutter, and you almost need her to motivate you to get back, even though she was the one that was hurt.
Yeah. Yeah. She felt really sorry, and it was very weird, you know.
And how long did it take to get you and your dad talking again? Your dad says that to you, it crushes you, and I don't know if that affects the relationship or not, but you probably think about it on a daily basis at that point because you're so bummed, and I know you were tight with your sister.
Yeah, that actually, my sister and I brought us closer together after the accident, and yeah, I was kind of pissed, but I was also ashamed, you know, that I kept going skiing, because it's a dangerous sport. You feel selfish, you know, when the things that you do can hurt other people, you know. I know when I got hurt, you know, it really hurt my friends, and it hurt me by my parents. And yeah, The word that comes to me is just self, like being selfish, you know, when you make, you do dangerous stuff that can put yourself in danger. It also puts others around you on a weird spot, you know, because everybody was asking about me, you know, after, before and after my sister was hurt, my family, my cousins and aunt and uncles and stuff, you know, they wanted to know what I was doing. So my parents, they always had to say, you know, oh, Mark is still skiing, you know, and they were scared for me, you know.
But I will say that, you know, if it's me and I've got a family and I'm going to go do something crazy, yeah, that's pretty selfish of me, because I'm going to come home. And if I don't come home, that ruins the lives of some other people. Now, you are a professional athlete. These things are expected from you. While everyone knows that these things are dangerous and it could be looked at as selfish, but you are the cream of the crop who are able to push the limits. But it sounds like there's some doubt, I guess, in your head if it's the right choice to even go on skiing.
Yeah. Yeah, totally. But it's just the way it ended up. My sister got hurt. I got messed up. And then, believe it or not, but my brother also broke his back.
No way. After?
Yeah, a few years after I did mine. So
that is crazy.
Yeah, like I don't know what to think, you know. And after I got hurt, people start falling like flies, you know, one after the other. I would probably still be skiing and doing dangerous stuff if I wasn't hurt, you know, but it's a big reality check, you know.
Yeah, and it sounds like you got hurt, and then after you got hurt, were you saying a lot of people started falling off? People started dying. It was like you got injured and you're still here.
Yeah, exactly. Like I can count at least 10 people that I met and that I work with that died right after me, you know. And it makes you think about it, you know. It makes you wonder what it means, you know, to be good at sports. Like once you're dead, you know.
Yeah.
And whatever the influence that you made on other people and your career and all that, it just sucks, man. Like when GP died, I was very bummed, like even more pissed off that when I got hurt, I think. And we're celebrating the first year of GP's death. And the very next day, it's a rubberneck that dies, you know?
Yeah.
It was the day after, you know? And that was really messed up. And then other people died with it.
Yeah, well, you know, I met you for the first time. I was definitely aware of you for a decade. But I think we met the first time at the K2 Back 9 the night before the event. You and I ended up going to the bar. Everybody else decided they needed to get some sleep. But we knew that sleep was overrated. And you went ahead and destroyed that event. I think you took home second or third place in that overall.
I'm not sure. Second or third, yeah.
Yeah, second or third. Mike Douglas won it, so he was the oldest contest winner in any kind of contest in skiing's history. But then you took second or third, and it was really the first of its kind of a contest that was like the Red Bull Cold Rush and some of those other events. And it was just awesome, the crew that we had. JP, Sage, yourself, Andy Mayer was there. Bushfield was there. Ben Chetler, Douglas. It was a phenomenal crew of skiers. I would say 3 weeks after that event, you're shooting and you're standing on top of a big rock pile and the fog rolls in. And what happens?
Well, we were doing like helicopter skiing, heli skiing, and then we were there maybe for 10 days. It sucks because when I arrived there, I was not very in a good mood. And there was some weird feelings as soon as I got there. And then the very last day before we leave, the last run of the day, the last run of the trip, we were all tired, but we decided that we were going to do another run before we leave. And that's when I got hurt.
Everybody always says, you never say it's your last run or anything like that. But the last run of the trip, was there any pressure to even take the run, or was it just something like, hey, we're just going to get one last lap in?
Yeah, I felt pressure because, you know, like it was the last effort before we go, you know?
Yeah. And so you want to get one more thing on film?
Yeah. Like I remember very well, I was sitting there. I was like hoping that we were not going to do another run and being tired and being exhausted. I was probably the first one saying, okay, I'm going to do this then, you know?
Yeah.
But a second before, I was like hoping we were not going to ski another run, you know?
Yeah.
And we're just sitting there watching at something very easy, something probably not even worth shooting because it was very small. And then I got fucked up, you know, like just doing something very not meaningful, you know?
Yeah.
Yeah, I'm pretty bummed out. Like, I'm not bummed out about choosing skiing as a career and a way of life, but I'm very bummed that I skied that run, you know?
Yeah. And it's something that when it happens like that, it's very easy for you to pinpoint that run. You can look at everything that went into that trip, how tired you were at the end. And it's just like you look at that one decision and then you can look back on your life. And throughout this interview, you've said you have trouble making the right decision when it's time to do that.
Yeah.
And maybe the line was part of that because
it's true that
you could have just chilled and been done for the day. But when someone says, hey, Marc-André, it's your turn, you're like, fuck yeah, I'm going to do this.
So dumb.
So that happens and you end up in the hospital. You have a bunch of surgeries. How long until you know that you're actually not going to walk again?
Right away, pretty much. It took me a while before I got back because I kind of passed out or whatever. But as soon as I was in the helicopter, I could tell that I was paralyzed because I couldn't move. And it was like probably hurting like crazy. And then when I showed up at the hospital, as soon as they saw the MRI, they told me that there was probably no chance that I could, it was too damaged, you know.
At this point, with technology and things they're doing, is there any hope in the future that you will walk again? Or is it something that you've come to grips with that, hey, this is just how I'll roll?
For sure that there's some technology now that probably allows people to get up on their feet. But like I use crutches at first. And a knee brace so I could get up. But it's kind of weird because the people that I was doing my rehab around here in Quebec, they told me that it was probably not the best thing to do because it would put a lot of pressure on my shoulders and you could get hurt doing it, you know, and then get all messed up and then not even being able to push your wheelchair, you know. But I would have liked to do it more. But at first I did walk with crutches and stuff.
Okay.
I found that the wheelchair is more, it's maybe I'm lazy, but it's more practicable.
Yeah, and I wouldn't say you're lazy at all because you're working your ass off when you're going places. It's probably become second nature to you because at this point you're used to it. But I can think in the first few months of getting into a chair, first you have to get comfortable with yourself being in it because you used to be a professional athlete and now you're going out in public, seeing people that maybe you've seen before, and they used to put you on a pedestal of athlete. And I would think conversations are awkward and a lot of things are awkward for you. And I would think there's depression as well.
Yeah. Yeah. I went through rough times since my injury for sure. But it's just the bad habits that I had before. It's kind of weird because when I got hurt, people that didn't know me very well, they probably thought that I would get away with it and have a successful life and that I could go through this very easily, you know. But I think the people that know me very good, they knew that that I was in for a hard time, you know, just because I had very bad habits.
Oh, yeah. No, I definitely even heard about it at that time. Like when it was going on, people were worried about just how you were going to be because, yes, they're bad habits. And it sounds like you can get into funks that'll put you in a depressed state and you need people around you like the Steves and the Alexes and those people that motivated you. You probably needed people like that or a JP around to really get you out of the funk and get you focused on getting better.
I had a lot of good people around me through my whole life, you know. Definitely Steve Rosendahl and Peter O'Brien and Dash. Like, I can't name them all.
Yeah.
I kept skiing after I was hurt. So I kept going to hang out with my good friends afterwards. So everyone has been very supportive, I think. Maybe even too much, you know, like, I think it's hard to help someone, you know, that is in trouble sometimes, you know. I think everybody meant really good for me, but I think it's hard to deal with somebody who's in a struggle, you know. And sometimes I feel like they've been maybe too nice to me, you know. I was pretty messed up afterwards. I was always on drugs, medication, and I was drinking a lot, smoking a lot, and I was doing the more than often, I was doing the wrong thing, you know, to get back on my feet. Instead of making the right choice again, I was taking the wrong choice pretty often, you know. It was very hard, I think, on the people around me to see me struggle like that.
And we're talking 2007, 2008, because the accident happens in 2006. And so over the next 2 years is when you're in making these bad decisions and also figuring out how to live the rest of your life. When do you eventually start making the right decisions?
Well, I think it's a few months ago. I've had a hard time, man. It got worse on some points and better on some points, but I've been struggling a lot since the last 10 years. It's been 11 years now, I think.
Yeah.
I made some very good choices recently. I quit doing drugs and quit alcohol for now. I made a deal with myself that I was not going to drink for 1 year. And now it's been almost a year and a half since I drank. And I don't smoke weed. I don't smoke cigarettes anymore.
Boring. I'm kidding.
No, but I'm always in the bars. I'm always playing music and doing exactly what I was doing before, but except that I don't drink anymore and I don't smoke. So I'm very, very happy of myself. I think that's going to help me out because I had a lot of struggles. Compulsive behaviors and shit like that. And I think my injury only made it worse, you know, for a while anyways.
Yeah.
Yeah. So I feel like I'm only getting, how can I say that?
Like on the right road?
Yeah. Since just a few months. It's been just a year or so, you know, since I feel like I can function better and that it's going somewhere, you know, but still.
How old are you at this point?
I'm 36.
Okay, so it took you 36 years to become an adult and it happened 3 months ago. But it's better late than never, right? Well, man, your story, it's a crazy one. I mean, it's had ups and downs and a lot of ups and downs, not just your injury, but then injuries throughout your family, you being a criminal as a youth, and then having problems all throughout. All while being one of the best skiers on the planet. So you can tell that just because you have talent doesn't mean you're happy. And it sounds like you were going back and forth between happiness and not happiness and struggling. And it was all in your head and expectations that people put on you. And you kind of were just wanting to chill and see it all happen.
Yeah, I think you're right on a lot of points. It was big ups and big downs. Yeah, I think you're right on that. It was the most exciting things and then the worst thing ever, you know, like
all rolled into one.
Yeah.
All right, Mark. Well, I want to thank you for coming on the sponsored podcast. And then we're going to jump over. I've got another little 10-minute thing that we'll do that's called Inappropriate Questions, where Mike Hattrip put together an inappropriate question for you. And then I put together two others.
Okay.
And then we'll have you ask inappropriate questions to Rory Silva. So I'm going to thank you for this one. And then we'll jump on another one in 1 sec.
All right.
So that was time with Marc-André Béliveau. It sounds like his life trajectory is pointed in the right direction, and it'll be interesting to see what happens with Mark in the years to come, as he's overcome a lot from a life-altering injury to going to school and where he is today. Mark has had a long road with a lot of bumps in it, but he has come out on top, and hopefully we'll continue to see him on top. Next Monday on the Powell Movement, we have our first summer-based guest. We're talking about Tom Schaar. He's a 17-year-old skateboard professional. He's the first kid ever to do a 1080. We're going to talk to Tom about life as a 17-year-old, making a ton of money, and how that affects him and his psyche. So that's Monday on thepowellmovement.com. As always, I want to thank you for tuning in. And if you have any feedback for me, you can reach me at mike@thepowellmovement.com. Have a great rest of your week, everyone, and talk to you next week.